Thanks, Joe. I guess the main point of this week's activity is not a lot of talks, but a lot of interactions. I've prepared this talk rather full of material. It's an overview of the work done at Imperial College and collaborators with Imperial Group, and it's designed to provoke discussion. So if you have any questions, I'd be very happy to take them whilst we're going along. I have a website which is in the process of being updated. It is pretty much up to date with publications, and somewhere embedded in this website you will find papers referring to most of the things I shall talk about this morning. Here are the collaborators. I've been fortunate in my collaborators, many of them, and they've hugely influenced my approach to this exciting topic. Okay, so just the concepts which are behind our approach. A conventional lens is limited in performance because, as you know, you have to increase the aperture of the lens to get more resolution. But the maximum aperture is a 90-degree aperture, and that corresponds to a momentum parallel to the surface, a wave vector parallel to the surface of omega over C0. And that's the highest order Fourier component that you can put towards an image. That limits the resolution to something of the order of the wavelength of light. You can do better, but if you want to do better, you have a problem, because these higher Fourier components lead to waves which don't propagate freely. They're evanescent waves. They decay, because now inside this argument, you have to reverse the order of these two guys, and you get a factor of I outside, leads to evanescent waves. So you can get a better image, but this was never taken seriously before my MagCap paper of 2 years ago, because it was known that you have to amplify this wave to restore it, to make its correct contribution to the image. So you might say that what we're doing is attempting the impossible. We're trying to make a lens which will focus these extra Fourier components, which will focus the near field. Now, before I tell you how we do that, I want to tell you about some of the ingredients which make it not possible, but feasible. It may be possible. It hasn't been done yet experimentally, but we heard last week at the Peers Conference that there's some very hopeful possibilities. And it turns out that the key to the story is the minus sign. You have to invert the sign of more or less everything in sight, and that really means epsilon and mu.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah. Okay, the near field and the far field are classified by their wave vectors parallel to the surface, perpendicular to the direction of propagation. And so if this guy inside here is positive, then we're in the near field, because kz is a complex number. If this number is negative, then kz becomes real, and you have a free field which propagates. So it's quite... Excuse me?
So you're not considering it in the sense of an aperture? In your field, then...
Well, you could do. The maximum physical aperture you can get is when the angle is 90 degrees, but if you're willing to consider a complex angle, if you like, so values of sine theta which are complex, then you can make the aperture wider. One way of looking at it.
It's the area of the aperture divided by the wavelength.
But behind this is the concept of ray optics rather than wave optics, isn't it?
Behind, I think there are various things one has to be careful about here. One is the angular resolution of a lens, and I'm not talking about that. The angular resolution of the lens is given by the ratio of by the aperture, and that's the angular resolution. But I'm talking about the spatial resolution here. And that's different and has different criteria. So you have an angular resolution, which you can make as small as you like by designing a telescope with an aperture as big as you like. And that can make the angular resolution very small. But it can never exceed this limit here, however big the aperture is, because you can never make this angle bigger than 90 degrees.
Well, I'll tell you what's confusing me. I'm sorry to be interrupting. Is that how do you make connection with our concepts of near field and far field, say, in classical electrodynamics?
Well, that is the connection.
This is the
Yeah, that's just classical electrodynamics. Okay.
The near field refers to evanescent waves.
Yeah, correct. It's in the what?
If you assume that your source is in the far field of the lens,
the far field of the lens didn't have a far field. It's only the source.
So the confusion here is between Fresnel zone and you have to think
you're talking about the lens.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about the Fresnel zone.
Yeah. Okay, I think these are
sort of founded on the angular spectrum.
Yeah.
Of plane waves analysis that is based on planar surface emission rather than finite source emission. So that the 1/r, 1/r² 1/r³ contributions that you get from emitting elementary sources don't even show up here.
Okay, this is a fairly basic thing, and I can quite see that we could have quite a long discussion on it, which we perhaps ought to have. But if I could have reviewed the other things, and so could we put a little asterisk on that near field, far field thing? And it's something I'd be very happy to discuss with you in my office or at later times. It's a very interesting. We all have our own personal way of looking at it, and
we're on safe ground if we ride along with you on the notion that we'll be dealing with evanescent field components.
Yeah, that's if you're happy with evanescent fields, that's what I'm going to be talking about. So now I want to make a diversion into metamaterials, because if you want to achieve these negative values of permittivity and permeability, then metamaterials are going to play a role. Epsilon isn't too bad, because if you look at metals, particularly silver, which is a low-loss material, then metals have this plasma-type response here. And for frequencies below the plasma frequency, this number here is essentially a negative with a small imaginary part, and you have negative values of epsilon until the frequency gets so small that the losses begin to dominate. Very, very low frequencies, or low relative to optical in the gigahertz region, you can make an artificial plasma, and you do this with a thin wire structure. And the idea of this structure is that you do two things. One is that you dilute the electron concentration, so the N effective of the electrons is small. The thin wires have very high inductance, and that looks like an electron mass through the A vector, so you get a high mass, and this reduces the plasma frequency by many orders of magnitude, and essentially it's given by this geometrical quantity here. If the inductive mass dominates over the electron mass, if it doesn't, you have to use another formula, but at these dimensions it does. And now this guy, for dimensions of the order of a few millimeters, gives a plasma frequency at microwave frequencies with very similar responses to what you'd see in silver, except that it's all scaled down in frequency. Well, in the realization we made, A was about 5 millimeters and R was about 50 microns. So the log, which actually is important for reasons I could explain separately, the log was about 7 or 8. More difficult was the problem of how to make mu negative. And there are very few naturally occurring materials with a negative value of mu. If you do find it, it's over a very narrow frequency range, and it's usually associated with heavy losses, which kind of kills off all the effects we're seeking here. But a few years ago, I had a go at designing a meta-material which had negative mu, and the prescription was to wind this Swiss roll structure, which is a roll of conductor which never touches itself, and the idea is that this forms a resonator, so that when you put a magnetic field along here, it induces a current round the loop which charges the capacitor and has a resonant frequency defined by the inductance of the loop and the capacitance of the loop. The capacitance is very high because you have many turns here, the inductance is high. And then you stack these rods in a two-dimensional array, and what you find is that as you tune through the resonant frequency, the effective permeability goes up to a large value, and then as you tune through the resonance, it reverses its sign, and you have a region here where you have negative mu. These are actual measurements compared to theory. This was very lossy. It turns out that we hadn't appreciated just how bad dielectrics are, and these losses are mainly due to the glue in the dielectric. The dielectric constants, the glue we used. You can do much better than this. On resonance, these sticks look like magnetic metals. They behave as though there are magnetic monopoles inside them conducting magnetic field. Move away from the resonance and you get this magnetic plasma effect where mu can go negative. Here we barely achieve minus one, but you can make much, much better specimens now.
John?
Yeah. The measurement was done by stacking a whole lot of these together and just putting a big loop of wire around it. Simple as that. Excuse me?
How much better have you achieved?
Oh, the figure of merit is this value of mu imaginary here, which is a measure of how good the resonance is. Typically, we're achieving 13, and individual rolls, we think we can get that up to about 30, and that's a measure of the Q factor of the resonance. And then mu real goes down to minus 3, minus 4, something like that. Okay. This is the design of choice if you're working in the megahertz region, because it's very low frequencies. It works at, this is designed to work at 27 megahertz, which is the MRI scanner sort of frequency. And its other virtue is that it really is a very good metamaterial, because the ratio of the lattice spacing to the free space wavelength is about a factor of 1,000. So this is truly behaving as though it's an effective medium. Its structure is much smaller than the wavelength. Pickies? That's a bit dark. Sorry about that. Never mind. This is just showing how we make these Swiss rolls. They're coils of a printed circuit board which are insulated, and you can see the copper glinting at the end. Is it possible to have it? That's better. Thank you very much. This is a further out view, and the color you see here is the insulator on the circuit board, and this is just a ceramic dowel down the center, and the scale is 1 centimeter. More popular, because it doesn't involve you spending your life in a cigar factory rolling Swiss rolls on your thigh or whatever they do in cigar factories. And much less labor intensive is this split ring structure. But the concept is the same. You put a magnetic field down this ring. The rings are split, so a current can't flow right around the ring and can only flow by charging the capacitor between the inner and the outer ring. And the whole idea of the split ring was to reduce the capacitance so that the frequency went up. And these structures have typical dimensions of a few millimeters in diameter, a gap of a fraction of a millimeter between the inner and outer rings, and these will resonate around 10 gigahertz. And that's proved the most popular structure because you can manufacture it by etching techniques. And here's one which was made at Marconi, or by for Marconi. And of course, David Smith and Shelley Schultz have extended this concept immensely. And this is a structure which I shall talk about in a moment, in which you have a split ring structure combined with a wire structure. And I dare say David will be telling you something about that structure and its children. So here, the story, where the story took off for me, because I presented these results on negative mu and negative epsilon at the meeting at Laguna Bay 2 or 3 years ago, and David and Shelley were there. And did Shelley actually fall off his chair when he saw this? Anyway, he was very excited about it. And because they realized that if you could make these guys negative both together, something really interesting happens. Of course, if you have negative epsilon, as you do in silver, all the fields become transparent because you're taking the square root of a negative number to get the wave vector, and light doesn't go through silver below the plasma frequency. However, what David and Shelley knew, and Veselago knew many years ago actually, was that here's the wave vector, and of course if epsilon is negative, this is complex, so you're getting an evanescent field. But if they're both negative, you're restored to a real wave vector. So you might imagine that something which is kind of interesting and exotic, like a plasma, was restored to something which is boring. But it isn't boring, and I'll show you why not. But first of all, this is the famous experiment which David and Shelley did. If you have if you have a positive epsilon just there, then the ring structure has a gap here where mu is negative and you see no transmission. You make epsilon negative as well as mu, and it absolutely reverses because here epsilon is negative, mu is positive, and when they're both negative, you come to this transmission region here. So that was a very nice proof that you had negative mu. Now, the really key thing was to realize what happens to other quantities, because if you do the matching at the surface in Maxwell's equations, then this material just doesn't behave like normal material. Yeah, it's got a real wave vector, but it actually, properties can be interpreted as having a negative refractive index. The crude argument for this is that if you have minus times minus and you take the square root of minus squared, then it's minus, isn't it? But that wouldn't work with most mathematicians. Most mathematicians would want me to draw a diagram like this, which I can easily do. Epsilon always has a positive imaginary part, so if you imagine that epsilon lies along this line here, and maybe you scan along here as a function of frequency. So that's epsilon, and it's always got a positive imaginary part. So when you take its square root, you must go around here and go up the positive imaginary axis. And the same thing is new to mu. So when you take the square root of mu, that does the same thing. So positive I times positive I gives negative, and that's why this guy is negative by argument of analytic continuation. Though, of course, you will have to verify that by solving Maxwell's equation and showing that what really happens is you get this weird phenomenon of negative refraction, which is still proving controversial, and people still are writing physical review letters saying it's crap, but I think we can deal with that. What you have to have is that, the energy flow has to be away from the surface. So if you have negative refractive index, then that would say that the energy flow. The matching of wave vectors is okay because the wave vector has the opposite sine to the group velocity, but must be parallel to the group velocity because this is an isotropic medium we're thinking about, and so the wave vector component parallel to the surface matches, and that's okay too. So the phase velocity and the group velocity are both negatively refracted. And if you go through what the consequences of that are, then if this has n equals minus 1, which is the canonical case, if you like, then an object will form two images, one inside the medium and one outside. The images are not inverted or anything. They're the right way up, and they're exactly the same size as the object. But when I came to look at that, I noticed something very extraordinary, which for some reason hadn't been spotted before. And that was that the transmission coefficient of the lens is actually perfect if you choose the condition n equals minus 1. All the waves go through without any reflection at the internal surface, so all the propagating waves contribute perfectly to the image. Not only that, but if you then look at these other waves we've been talking about, which are the evanescent waves, which correspond to very large wave vectors parallel to the surface, and therefore imaginary values of kz, decaying waves, then for some magical reasons, you've done all the mathematics, you've matched the amplitudes at the surface, and the answer is that this thing is behaving as an amplifier for the evanescent waves, and magically it does this job of reconstructing a perfect image. And that was a result I was astounded by. I had not been taking hallucinogenic substances, but just to be sure, I put it in my drawer for a couple of months till I'd calmed down a little bit. I looked at it again. It was bright as far as I could see. I talked to a few colleagues. They said, "You're crazy," but they couldn't say why. And then I published it. So that was the start of a bit of a firestorm. How does this thing work? Well, here are the... let me make a simplification. In the ideal case, you need both mu and epsilon equals minus 1. Then you get a perfect lens. But if you're talking about the extreme near field, when the waves are very evanescent, electricity and magnetism decouple. And at very, very short length scales, you can just talk about the electrical effect. And then you don't care about mu, so you can throw mu away, call it free space, mu equals 1. And then epsilon equals minus 1 will actually, won't focus everything, but it will focus these very, very short wavelength components. And kz then is just given by this guy here. So if you take this limit, the transmission coefficient gets a lot simpler. And you can see what's going on now. Because when epsilon is plus 1, that's free space. And this is essentially unity. And the thing is transmitted with an advancing phase. Or if it's evanescent, it is transmitted with a reduction in amplitude. But if epsilon is minus 1, the whole thing gets turned upside down. Because this vanishes. This is 2 and cancels with this. And then the 2 here gives a minus 1 there, so you get just the opposite of what you got before. It's like time goes backwards or something. And so the lens unwinds the effect of an equivalent distance of free space, whether it's a decay or what have you. Now, I came from electron physics and collective motion and all that, and I knew very well the condition epsilon equals minus 1 was a condition for a surface plasmon. Duncan Haldane has a preprint in which he says, "I didn't realize that," but he's mistaken. So somehow these surface plasmons are bound up in this action of the lens. And when you think about it a little bit, you can see why. Because here's a free surface on silver, and here's a surface plasmon. And it's the potential associated with the plasmon, and the gradients either side have opposite signs because the E field has to reverse sign across a surface when epsilon is minus 1. Now, this is a guy which is not allowed at a free surface, but it does, in fact, match the boundary conditions, but it does it in the opposite way. And these guys are actually growing away from the surface, so they no boundary conditions satisfied here, nor in the material. But this guy, the anti-surface plasmon, is a useful catalyst because he can act as an intermediary. And if you join these two guys together so that he stops at an object here, which is actually radiating this decaying wave, then there's a kind of slingshot because it matches the boundary conditions here, as we've seen. The gradients are equal and opposite. And what's decaying for this guy is actually growing for this guy here. So you get amplification, and then you release into free space, and the wave field decays the value it had to start with. So you get just the right amount of amplification for each Fourier component. Right. We're working in the electrostatic limit, so there is no scale to this. The scale is set by the thickness of the lens. So if you take this realization of the lens, then you can imagine that the objects and the resolution are all set by that scale. So in this limit, this silver lens would be typically a few tens of nanometers, and the resolution may be 4 or 5 times better than that for silver. But there are ways of doing better, as I wish. Yeah.
From which they get some intuition.
Yeah. Absolutely, yes. Yes, that's all you need. Yes.
What is the physics of that model? Behind this?
Well, the physics is that this surface plasmon here, which develops in highly resonant form on the surface, is supported by a free electron, well, not necessarily free electron, but collective electron motion inside the bulk of the metal. So the electrons are
slashing
back and forwards with a spatial frequency corresponding to that wave vector at the surface. So there are currents in here supporting the surface charges. And that's very, very well known. I think Rufus Ritchie in about 1956 or so wrote a paper explaining how surface plasmons came about. So they've known for a long time.
Spatial behavior where it recovers on the other side. Can you see that from this model?
Oh yes, this is just follows from epsilon equals minus one. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is just the solution of the electrostatic equation, e to the minus k parallel. And then you match at the surface, you go to the opposite sign when epsilon equals minus one. And you can just see by looking at it, it matches. Because it's electrostatics, it obeys the same equation everywhere. It's just the question of the matching condition. Okay? Yeah, but if you go to small enough distances, much less than the wavelength, then it's quasi-static. Okay. At very short distances, electricity doesn't know about magnetism. Disconnected. You have to have long distances so that they can talk to one another. Okay, what's the limit to the resolution? Well, the limit is not the aperture, but it's a loss. So if you have a lossy material, so it's minus one plus I delta, and of course you always have a lossy material, don't you? So then the transmission coefficient is given by this guy here. Now all is well if delta squared is small compared with this guy here. And this guy here is the square of the decay which the wave experiences across the sample if the sample were air. So if this decay isn't too strong, then you get the amplification, and that's fine. But once you try to do too much amplification, and you have to compensate for too much decay, so for very big values of kx, these become comparable, and the whole thing collapses, and you're back in the exponential decay mode once again. And the condition for that is suggest that these two guys are equal, and that's the maximum resolution that your lens can achieve. And so you see the maximum detail that can be resolved, the scale is set by the thickness of the lens, and the detail you can resolve is set by the log of the imaginary part of epsilon. And this means that you get a certain amount of resolution. If you want to make the resolution better, you've really got to make delta very, very small, because log increases very, very slowly. So it's hard to get extremely good resolution. By the way, this cutoff ensures that the infinite fields, which have been referred to in somewhere in the literature, never occur, because you never actually amplify the infinitely large Fourier components in a real system. Okay. And if you apply that simulation for using the realistic values of epsilon for silver, then if you take two slits as an object separated by, let's see, what are they separated by, 80 nanometers or something like that, then in the image plane, this is what the potential squared would look like without the silver slab. So very much reduced in intensity. You can't resolve the two slits. You put the slab in place, you get a lot of amplification by about a factor of 5. But more important, the higher Fourier components are preferentially amplified, and you get this this resolution back again. Of course, I've carefully chosen all the numbers, so that works out nicely. But we're trying to see whether that can be done in experiment. Yes?
Excuse me, for what wavelength is relevant?
This wavelength here, silver, has a surface plasmon somewhere in the visible. I don't have the numbers for the exact wavelength, but the surface plasmon for silver is in the visible.
It's just to be working at the visible?
Yes.
And my question is, you know that you can manipulate semiconductors like selectors.
Yeah.
Constant of one or a minus one or a minus 10.
Right.
Just by manipulating the extrinsic pair density.
Yeah.
Is it of interest for the?
It is of interest, yes. Providing with low loss.
Sorry, provided?
Providing the loss is low.
The loss is lower than in the metal, because every time
I see, yes. Yes.
Longer than that of silver.
Well, that, then those would be fantastic candidates for lenses.
The metal has a high positive, you can compensate just by doping it.
Okay, well, we really need low loss materials. Yeah. So if you can think of any way of doing that.
There's Kramers-Kronig relations that forbid you from, there's relationship between loss and.
Yes, but it isn't, the Kramers-Kronig is an integral relationship.
Yeah.
And the loss at a given frequency is not restricted by Kramers-Kronig.
In this case, what is the actual loss of silver, and can you actually?
Yes, the imaginary part is 0.4, and that's been measured. Yes, these are the measured values of epsilon for silver. Due to
copper loss, because we need this copper.
Right, yeah.
So are we saying that it's purely due to the losses of a copper loss in the conductor?
I think that's a different experiment. That was to do with the far field. This is to do with the near field. The near field experiment has not yet been done. Okay.
And here the loss of copper was actually imaginary for
this. Yes, that's right. That's
this is.
No. Okay. So losses are going to limit what we can do. I think, so, I mean, it's certainly possible to improve the resolution using silver. Just how much we can improve it depends on how, on practical realizations. So here's the original lens. Now, it's been observed by Laszlo Solimar and ourselves independently that if you cut the lens up into pieces, this doesn't matter for the functioning of the lens, because each little lens will give you its own bit of amplification like this. So if you have a perfect system, you can cut the lens up into as many bits as you like, and it will still result in the same amplification at the end. So distributed amplification is perfectly possible. However, this makes a tremendous difference to the resolution, and the reason is that here you have a very, very high electric field, so the field gets very tiny, you have to amplify it to a huge value, and then it gets back to where it is. And so you have huge fields in the silver here, and huge fields mean huge losses. If you distribute the amplification, then you never get to a really high field, and the more you distribute it, the more uniform the field is, and therefore the losses here will be much less severe than in this case, and that should help the resolution. And indeed it does, because if you compare the two slits experiment for the original slab lens, you get this rather poor resolution here. But if you chop it up into bits, into eight pieces of silver, then the resolution is pretty good, really. So the layered lens is much better than the original slab lens. So there are things you can do with design which will ameliorate the effects of absorption.
Is there some natural limit to this? That is, how about such a little silver vapor?
Yeah, there is a natural. There is a natural limit. We've been using a local approximation to the dielectric function of silver. And obviously, if you dice up the silver thinner than one atom, that will be an appropriate response function. So you can't cut the silver up to a degree that your assumptions about epsilon no longer hold. So I wouldn't want to cut it much less than a nanometer for sure, because below that length, you get into the Fermi-Thomas screaming length in silver, and you get inside the dielectric function, and it doesn't respond like a piece of slab of silver anymore. So, but I think between those two extremes, there is quite a lot of potential for using this dicing technique to improve resolution. Now, not only is this slicing technique good for resolution, it also does something else which is interesting. So let me make a diversion. Maybe some of you have seen this stuff called TV rock. Have you seen this stuff? It's real fun to play with. It's a naturally occurring mineral. I give its chemical formula there. And its physical constitution is of a set of rather fine optical style fibers running the length of the material. You dig this stuff out of the ground, amazingly enough. And, okay. And it's called TV rock because with my high aperture Nikon, I've tried to show you what's happening here. You put it on a bit of paper, and you focus on the paper. You cut. You find that the image where the rock is, this is the outline of the rock, is out of focus. And the reason is that the image, and you now pull back and you focus on the top of the rock, the image is just transferred to a TV screen on the top of the rock. So everything that's on the bottom of the rock is just taken along the fibers and presented to you at the top of the rock. Now, of course, this effect functions because this is optical fiber. We know all about endoscopes and so on. So that's well understood. But what I want to show you is that I can make some TV rock which will work not with as though the fibers were 100 microns across, but as though the fibers were a fraction of a micron across. So I'm going to make TV rock for the near field. Okay. And it turns out that this lens here with diced up silver is actually electromagnetically equivalent to a system of very, very fine wires with infinite conductivity, providing the metal is perfect, and with zero permittivity in this direction here. So So this guy here can be transformed into a fiber bundle. Let me show you how that's done. Very easy to prove. So I'm going to look at the effective dielectric function in the z direction. And if I put a D displacement field in the z direction perpendicular to the slices, then D will be constant, but in each slice the electric field will be inversely proportional to the dielectric function. So the average inverse dielectric function is just a half this guy. However, ideally this is plus one and this is minus one. It's not ideal, so this isn't quite zero, but it's almost zero. So epsilon z is very, very large, and it's limited only by the absorption of the system. It would be infinite if there was no loss. What about epsilon x, which is parallel to the thin sheets? Well, this time it's E, which is the same everywhere in space. So the average D is proportional to the average of these guys. That's zero again to first approximation. Actually, it's given by delta. So epsilon x is zero. So you have the most extreme anisotropic material you could imagine, with epsilon z infinity and epsilon x of zero. And if you look how waves propagate through this system, then they propagate with a wave vector which is almost zero. So it's as if the thing has been splattered flat like that. The top surface equals the bottom surface. You can estimate the losses, or the loss of resolution, because we've actually carried along these losses here, and the resolution will be killed when this wave vector z is such that you get substantial decay in the length of the system, and so the resolution again is limited by delta, but this time a much more benign dependence on delta. This time, if you make delta small, the resolution is proportional to delta, not 1 upon log delta. So the resolution of this lens can be very much better than the silver, and that's why you saw that huge improvement. But the really neat thing about this is this fiber optic trick, top to bottom, splat together. And I think that's going to be very important for some applications. Okay, so pursuing this, actually, Joe, you're going to cut me off in 10 minutes, aren't you? Right. So I'm going to skip all this stuff, interesting as it is. And because I think this last topic may provoke some discussion. The original so-called perfect lens, when you come to look at it and get a little bit picky, you say, well, it may be perfect, but it's a bit of a dull lens because the object and the image are exactly the same size. So it sure ain't a magnifying glass. And what's more, the distance between them is rigidly set to be twice the distance across the lens itself. So that's quite restricting, I guess. And, you know, where's the beef? Where's the magnification? Turns out that making the lens magnify is rather hard. You say, well, why don't you curve the surfaces? Sure, you can curve the surfaces, and that will focus the far field. But unfortunately, all these nice properties of capturing the near field completely go out of the window. And the reason is that if you take a flat surface and distort it into a spherical surface, these plasma resonances, which are all lined up at the same frequency, whatever the wave vector, for a flat surface, when you have a curved surface, the plasma resonances of the surface are all over the place and they're not degenerate anymore, and so the lens doesn't work. You've spoiled it. However, there is a situation of a curved surface where all the surface plasma frequencies are lined up. So here is the flat slab. If you have a spherical surface, then the plasma frequency disperse with the quantum numbers L and M, so that they're all different. But for a cylinder is like a flat slab in that its plasma frequencies, surface plasma frequencies, whatever the value of angular momentum, they're all the same. And you might guess that if anything could make a lens, and this guy could, and it turns out that that's right. It does, but it's only in 2D, and it's only for the near field. So it's as if that if you want to magnify, you've got to have the near and far fields part company. You can only do it either for the far field or for the near field. If you want to do it for the near field, this is how to do it. But so far, we can only do it in two dimensions. So here you go. You put a charge here, and you postulate fields here, which obey the boundary conditions at infinity by matching at the surface. And you do all that matching stuff, and what you find is that this is the field associated with a charge here. Okay, so 1 upon r to the n is the potential due to a single cylindrical charge, and that's summed over 1 to infinity. Here's the potential in this region here, but I want to draw your attention to the potential in this region out here. So it looks exactly like this guy, R1, which is the radius of this inner circle, n, r to the n, so it has exactly the form of this guy, but there's another factor in here caused by the presence of the lens, which is the ratio of the radii of the two cylinders to the 2nth power. Okay. Very significant. Of course, this guy you can fold into here, and it looks as though all distances have been stretched by the square of the ratio of those two radii. In other words, there's magnification going on here. This behaves like a charge out here, but if you had two charges close together, they'd actually be separated by a distance which was the square of the ratio of those two radii. So you've got a magnifying glass here. And so a little object here goes to a big image there. There's a region here you can't image in the middle, but the white bit you can image, and that images to a region here. The magnification is linear everywhere, so you have a mapping of this space into this space. Conversely, though I haven't shown you, you have a mapping of this space into this space, so if you put a source out here, it would appear as though there were a charge inside, at least at some radii. Now, you might imagine that this just isn't an accident of nature. Oh, gee, a cylinder does it. How strange. Why is that? In fact, there's a deeper reason, because if you go back to all that ancient stuff on electrostatics, you will remember, I'm sure, that there's something called a conformal transformation. A conformal transformation of coordinates maps solutions of the electrostatic equations into other solutions of electrostatic equation, but in a different geometry, and the geometry is transformed according to the conformal transformation. Let me stop talking mumbo jumbo and tell you what the transformation is. So conformal transformations preserve solution of Laplace's equation, electrostatics, and it also preserves the boundary conditions at dielectric interfaces. Very nice. And if we consider this transformation here, then this transformation maps lines parallel to the u-axis into circles on the origin, centered on the origin in the z-plane, and it maps the other axis into the angular coordinate around those circles. So I can show you the solutions of the two planes. So here's a situation which we've had already. A periodic array of charges, let's say, which is trivial generalization of the lens, a periodic array of images generated, conformal transformation, we wind this round into a cylinder, and that gives you the result we got. So we didn't need to thrash away with matching all those equations. You could just say, hey, there's a conformal transformation. There's a solution. We know the geometry of the lens. We know what it's going to do. We don't have to do any calculations. We've done one calculation. We just put the conformal transformation in the solution, and there's the answer. There's more than one conformal transformation. Not all of them work. I can tell you why not if you're interested. Here's another one. This is inversion. Inversion takes planes into cylinders. So if you invert about this point here, this point is the furthest away, points at infinity map to the origin, so you wrap these planes around the origin, so this guy goes to Sue. And those of you who know something about surface plasmons will know that if you have a material with a pointy bit in it and a singularity, the spectrum is extremely interesting, and it is. So this guy is a lens. A charge here will appear here. But now the domain out here is not necessarily limited. And you can, in principle, map a charge to be infinitely big at infinity. Though, of course, you do that at the price of having an extremely perfect material, and it's never in practice realizable. So lots of fun with conformal transformations. Ever since I was a student and saw those lovely transformation in James Jean's book, I've been wanting to use them in anger, and this is the only occasion on which I've ever done so. So to conclude, the original perfect lens, it opened new vistas for manipulating the near field. Absorption is the bugbear. It's going to stop you doing quite a lot of the wonderful things you might want to do in practice. But we've got to get smart, and it is possible to get around some of these effects of absorption. I've given you one example of slicing the lens up, which makes things much, much better. The effect can be observed over a very wide range of frequencies. There are realizations at microwaves, there are realizations at optical frequencies. We're beginning to get to work on generalizing this. We can produce a 2D magnifying glass, but it only works on the near fields, unfortunately. However, that might be useful. It's my opinion that we've only scratched the surface of what's possible, and that smart people thinking about things which were unthinkable 2 or 3 years ago will produce new results. And that's what this meeting is about. Thank you for your attention. Oh, no, I don't know about that. Which Wyatt? Adrian Wyatt?
I got his initial.
At Exeter.
I think he's at Exeter.
Yeah. No, I don't know about it. I should do, because I know Adrian Wyatt. Okay.
I didn't bring the paper with me, unfortunately, but certainly. The idea is if you have a surface of superfluid helium.
Yeah.
And you shine individual helium atoms at this surface. Then it gives us a negative refraction effect, which instead of bending down in the usual way, it refracts.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, the reason is that if you... Can everybody see that over there? If you plot the dispersion relationship of helium atoms, you have this roton thing. And so you have a region here where you have negative dispersion. Okay, so if you tune here, you get this guy, which is the phonon branch, and you get this guy here, which is and the rotons negatively refract. Yeah, I hadn't realized that. Thank you for pointing that out. That's really neat.
So my question to extend that is, can you make a perfect lens with helium?
I don't know. I think the guy ought to try.
Anything you can do with optics, you can also do with
sure, sure, yeah, yeah.
So if you can get negative refraction in material waves, the Broglie waves, if you like, why not have a perfect lens?
Sure, yes. I don't know what the line width of this guy is, but it's worth a try, isn't it? Gosh, that's interesting. Where did he publish that?
It's just Red Letters. I'm sorry, I don't have the reference.
But it must be very recent.
No, it's actually quite ancient. I think it was in the... early 90s.
Right. Okay, that's why I haven't... Right. Yeah. Would you send me the reference? I'd be...
When I get back to Berkeley.
Right.
I don't have them. Well, maybe I have them, actually. I'll look it up. Okay.
Great. Yeah.
You have a transmission function with epsilon and minus 1 exactly. And I was just sending money to send it and see if I might be correct in this understanding.
if you get a transmission function which has the exact property state, basically kd as some one kd function.
This one here?
No, we have to have some input minus one and the input minus one and we have the transmission function. It's very much on your paper.
Sorry, a figure?
No, the transmission function, the equation for transmission function is that. I can tell you what it was, it's three. Okay, here.
Yeah.
So you're having a phase term that if you have the T solution is given by minus I K Z T, I suppose K Z T is the string vector along the you need to slot at the K Z prime.
Yeah, this is in the medium, and this is in free space, and in the short wavelength limit, they're degenerate.
Okay, so what basically the lens has, for the negative medium of the fan, you have a KZ outside that has a minus KZ inside.
Yeah.
Suppose I want to have an object, and I want to emit it to something.
Yeah.
It would go from point A to point B in normal space, mm-hmm. and suffer some sort of disturbance.
Yeah.
If I was going to produce the inverse of that system, if I were to characterize it in terms of John Goodman as the function of the transmission function of the network function of the engineering product, I would ask myself, well, as a result of propagation, I have some sort of dispersion and I can kind of classify it as some magnitude and some phase. If I want to compensate that, what I have to do, suppose I can make a perfect inverse system.
Yeah.
I have to produce the inverse of a magnitude of a T and e to the I phi. Magnitude in magnitude of transmission and a phase in phase of a transmission.
Right.
Right? So I have to compensate the phase from phi to minus phi.
Yeah.
That's perfectly what has happened.
Right, yes.
Of course, so that's perfect inverse of a network function. You have made a system that has a transmission function of e to the I phi, now you have compensated the phase by minus I phi. I have to compensate the amplitude too, because the inverse of a complex number has 1 over that in magnitude. So I have to get 1 over t in magnitude, e to the minus I phi. If I'm not even going to worry about the magnitude here, because the magnitude does not seem to appear, at least because you have Turing neglected laws, so I don't know what happens to the magnitude of the transmission function of this map. But I know one thing that bothers me at the long term, and I hear the question, the function. I know I can make the inverse of the system. But I cannot make the inverse of a system over an infinite bandwidth. That would be indeed a violation of causality. So, I would agree with the following point, that you certainly, given the boundaries of where you can play in the Kramer forward relationship, for a finite bandwidth, you can make the inverse of a system, which are control people, engineers, which what people call a causal inversion. You produce a causal inversion of a system over a finite bandwidth. And the essence of it is that you have this instability which a control people on the right half plane of omega plane. And they move it to the left half plane by the pre-factorization, pre-amplification, and a technique that is very well known between mathematicians and control people. So I do have no problem accepting the fact that you do make a causal inversion of a system over a finite bandwidth. However, to argue that if that is, can be done over an infinite bandwidth, to me, it seems a violation.
I don't think I did argue that.
And I myself, from an engineering point of view, you have a perfect sense that you will certainly make a perfect image within that understanding that it's not perfect for an infinite bandwidth of a system.
Immediately you go to finite bandwidth, you limit the resolution.
So therefore, it would be an ultimate resolution problem in this perfect bandwidth.
Oh, yeah. But in any case, your resolution is limited by the absorption, and that's much more severe than any bandwidth limitation.
The question of absorption has been bothering me because I assume that you certain things of cylinder pointed out correctly that it attributed fully to the loss of a cylinder. I'm still not confused whether this really attenuation that, for example, seen in actual spread structure becomes a response to that. Or even a slap, if it comes from mismatch, impedance mismatches between the field space and the
material.
In other words, is it due to reflection or is it really a lost energy
If you make this choice here, there's a perfect impedance match at the surface. And if you have a little bit of loss, then there's a little bit of impedance match, but that's not the really severe thing. It's this interference with the Q factor of the resonance that piles it up.
Excuse me, in this case, of course,
Yeah.
But again, that does not explain actually Montana loss that we see in the actual structure.
Which actual structure isn't an actual? Oh, but that's different. That's the far field, and the far field is very, very different from the near field. There are different criteria, and the near field is much less sensitive to absorption, much less sensitive, because. Sorry, did I say it that way around? I meant to say that the far field is much less, and the reason is. Not hard to see that if you're dealing with a near field, you don't have these fluctuations in amplitude, and once you've done away with those, you've gone a long way from making your loss problem doesn't go away, of course, but it's a lot less critical. And here you're trying to make a resonance for heaven's sake, and you're relying on that resonance to do the amplification, and you spoil the Q factor out of the resonance, gone. But that's not true of the far field. So David's experiment's different. Yeah.
Just a comment, you know. When you have an absorptive medium, I really worry about the approximation that you have homogeneous, the gradient of homogeneous and evanescent waves.
Yeah.
When you have absorption, they're all inhomogeneous waves. You cannot make that separation anymore. And then I wonder.
Sorry, I didn't quite get your point there.
If you have a lossless medium, you're looking at the angular structure representation, for example.
Yes.
You can break the waves into homogeneous waves and evanescent waves, which is what you've done.
Yes.
But when you have loss, you can't make that.
No, that's not true. You can. Yes, you can.
they all become inhomogeneous.
No. If there is nothing in Maxwell's equations which stops you having a homogeneous lossy system.
Because when you look at the angular spectrum representation, when you have the loss, there is all plane waves propagating in all directions have loss associated.
Yeah.
There are no longer just purely attenuating waves. There no longer are evanescent waves.
Yeah, no problem. Let me show you. Let's suppose I introduce some absorption here. So these guys now have an imaginary component. And all that happens is that this guy, as well as being having a real component, also has a decaying component. So the generalization when you have loss is that you get both change of phase and amplitude at the same time. But the concept of a wave vector remains valid.
If you look at the wave, all the waves, if you look at the attenuation, if you're doing a spectrum representation, maybe that's what we need to talk about. If you look at the waves that are propagating, in an inhomogeneous wave, for example, the wave whose amplitude variation is different than the phase variation. And so all of the waves, the attenuation in angular spectrum representation is going to be two directional propagation. And the attenuation is in the z direction, let's say.
Yes.
The only way that's homogeneous is the plane wave that's going down that axis. All the other waves become inhomogeneous. And there really is no separation between those waves.
Oh, I see, yes. What you're saying is that all waves decay.
Yeah, all waves.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Yeah. But what I'm trying to say sure. is that you cannot argue then that these waves, there is no longer a zone that you can say these are evanescent. That transition between that gap.
I thought you were saying the system was inhomogeneous. Excuse me. Yes, I agree.
You're taking your expansion, which is the homogeneous waves at the source, which is in free space.
Yes.
And you're also measuring it in free space. What happens to the material is just the solution of the problem, but there's still the separation at the source and the wave.
Yeah.
Right.
That's also true.
Yeah. I'm just what I'm trying to say, but sometimes you, for example, when you do a lot of absorption of the material, which is what I look at, you find interesting things also happening. You find,
sure.
For example, whether that the fractional approximation gets better, not worse. You get some very strange, bizarre things happening.
I
kind of wonder what these might be problems. If there would be something more in them, instead of making that distinction between a homogeneous and evanescent wave.
Like I said, I think we've just scratched the surface, and some things we think we understand. There's a lot more to be invented, and there's a lot more to be understood. I agree with that.
John, one thing that I should have required at the beginning here, probably all speakers should be required to put their room number on the board somewhere.
If I kind of knew it.
You've got it so recently, we know what it is.
Yeah, my room number is 1211.
Is your position or expectation that this negative index of refraction idea would show up in any kind of wave phenomenon, whether it's sound waves, quantum mechanics, or whatever?
In principle, yes. I mean, certainly in sound waves, particularly in periodic structures, you get regions of negative refraction. So I don't think there will be any problem about observing negative refraction for electrons, phonons, pretty much any wave. But if you want this focusing of the near field, it's not just necessary to have negative refraction. There are certain other things which have to be satisfied as well. And magically they are for electricity and magnetism under ideal conditions. But for other materials, for other waves, the satisfying of those conditions it's not obvious that you can get that. So yes, negative refraction for other waves, subwavelength imaging, very difficult, probably not. Okay.
The limit that you adopted near the end when the magnetic field was thrown away and the electric field focused on reduces the whole thing to scalar theory?
If
making it look then like Schrodinger theory?
Like Laplace's equation, yeah. Yes. Yes, if you work in the electrostatic limit for very, very short wavelength, that's you're working with del squared pi equals zero.
That's more than simply scalar wave equations.
Yes, it is. It's Laplace. Yes, it's electrostatics. I mean, if you could actually find a material which had epsilon and mu minus one at the same time, you wouldn't have to make that approximation. But the way you get epsilon minus one is you tune the frequency and you find, because these things are dispersive, and you find the frequency at which epsilon is exactly minus one. Now, imagine making material. What the hell would you then tune to get mu equals minus one? So, to be realistic, I think it would be very difficult to get them both minus one to a sufficiently high degree of accuracy. So that's why I've stressed this near field limit.
One other comment to come back all the way to the beginning of your talk, the agreement that we reached that we would be talking about evanescent domain and not worry too much about other kinds of language that one uses to talk about near fields, intermediate zones, and far fields.
Okay.
If we adopt for a moment that kind of language, then that puts us in the same domain of physical materials where surfaces aren't present anymore. Is that right? In the way that your infinitely sliced up silver slabs can't be sliced beyond the point at which you actually have dielectrics.
I don't think so, because this is an instance of the near field limit of evanescent waves, and the surfaces here are fairly central to the thing, because it's these surface states, if you want to call them that are actually doing the amplification.
Right. I think that's what I'm saying. When you stop having a surface, when instead of having a surface, you have individual distributed centers of silver cells.
Right. But we haven't got that here.
In the silver vapor. Then,
yeah.
Of course, you have to change your mode of description and talk about evanescent waves anymore is less sensible than to talk in terms of one over R cubed, one over R squared, one over R zone.
Let's see.
Also, could I raise a point about nomenclature? I mean, when you talk about amplification to a person like me who's doing quantum optics, quantum electronics, you always think of a laser application.
Mm.
This is a very different kind of concept.
Yeah.
So what I've been calling this, in the case of superluminal propagation, is what I call virtual application. So that you make a distinction between the usual case of inverted media and so on.
I think it's very good to make that distinction, because I think what threw everybody off the scent in the first instance was that if you think amplification, you immediately think power. But there are instances of these resonant fields which do amplify. I mean, sound is amplified. You know, wine glass, opera singer, you get very, very high vibrational amplitudes, and the power actually comes from accumulating the received power over a period of time. And if you do time-dependent simulations of these lenses, the short time response of the lens is completely different from this. I mean, just as a matter of interest, if you suddenly switch on the wave field of an object here, none of this gets established immediately. The first thing that happens is you excite a resonance on this surface. So this field this resonance kind of feeds itself into the second one, like two pendulums swinging, and eventually the energy winds up on this surface. So I always describe this as the photographic negative film. It has to be there, but the print you get on out the far side. Okay, the Q value will be the amplification that you need to do to compensate for the decay. So the ratio of this to this will be the Q factor.
In this resonant system, you're talking about storing energy over a long period of time. So as a numerical, what kind of numbers are we thinking about for these proteins?
Well, that depends. That depends on how much resolution you want, but you're talking about Qs of between 50 and 100 for silver.
Okay. That's not very high.
No, we wish we could do better, and you can do better by another trick you can play is that actually in the visible region silver is quite absorptive, but if you go into the infrared, the loss tangent of silver gets very, very much less. So if instead of doing this game in free space, you actually put dielectrics on either side with a very high dielectric function, like 10 or something, then the matching condition is that 10 in the dielectric equals minus 10 in the silver. And to get that, you've got to tune into the infrared. And the losses are much less there, so you get a much better lens by doing that. Right here. Okay. Let me try and explain power flow if I can. Let's suppose this is lossless. Okay, that's simplified. So there's no power lost in here. But you put maybe an absorbing screen, a detector or something here that needs some power to detect things. Then the way this source demands power is to reflect another wave. So the absorber will demand power by reflecting a wave here. And if you have two evanescent waves decaying in opposite direction, and they have a phase difference between them, there'll be a power flow. And the phase will decide how big the power flow is and in which direction it is. So this thing re-radiates, if you like, another evanescent field, which ensures power flow. It ensures power flow all the way along, current conservation. And then, of course, the lens amplifies it. So you may think, well, you've got a decaying wave here. How does it demand power from this guy? And the answer is that the lens amplifies it, so it really can get the power that it wants from the object by having actually And this wave here arrives directly at the object and demands that it introduces some power. So evanescent waves conduct power in a very strange way. It's like tunneling, okay? So tunneling has decaying waves everywhere. So two electrons or two photons tunneling across a gap, they transfer power, all right, because you have propagating waves here and propagating waves coming out. But the way they do it is by having the two evanescent waves differing in a phase, and then you get transmission of power. Strange. It took me a long time to understand that, but fortunately I had to understand it as a grad student because I worked on electron diffraction, so one thing I knew already, I guess.